Earlier this week, we asked you for your questions about the climate talks in Copenhagen. And for some answers, we're joined by NPR science correspondent Richard Harris, who's at the Media Center in Copenhagen. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Melissa.
And we're going to get to those listener questions in a minute. But first, let's talk about what the goals of this conference there are, especially given the turmoil over the past few days, also how optimistic people are that the goals can be achieved.
Well, the goals are to come up with some sort of agreement, not even a treaty, but some sort of an agreement, a political agreement about what to do about global warming, and ultimately to have a treaty in a year or so from now. But it is proving to be very difficult. The more they talk, it seems, the more things they find to disagree about. And as we've been watching the trajectory of these talks, it seems to be getting harder and harder to find an agreement.
And the disagreements that have come up, the main ones, what are they?
Well, there are many, and I'll mention a couple. Money is a very big one. The developing world says it needs hundreds of billions of dollars over the coming decades to deal with the effects of global warming and to help them develop using clean sources of energy. There's no clear sense of where that money would come from and if that money could be raised, how it would be distributed. Another big issue is to what extent the rapidly developing countries like India and China will actually take legally binding steps to deal with their own emissions, which are growing very rapidly.
Speaking of the developing world, that brings us to our first listener question. This is from Fran Lissamore of Cleveland Heights, Ohio, and she asks, what is the definition of developing nation? China exports hundreds of millions of dollars worth of manufactured goods and is considered a developing nation. Why isn't China considered an industrialized nation, she wants to know.
That's a good question. You have to remember that a lot of these definitions really started some years ago when China was a much poorer nation. They still are, in many ways, a poor country as well as an industrialized country. The average Chinese, I think, earns about $3,000 a year, and that's far below what the average American earns. And there are more than 100 million Chinese in poverty. So part of China is still a very poor country and still trying very hard to develop, and part is highly industrialized.
We're going to go from a huge country to a really small one now. Another listener has a question about Iceland. Jay Menenga of Roberts, Montana, tells us that he visited Iceland recently. He met with people in their Ministry of Energy and was impressed by their efforts to become the world's first carbon-free country. And he wants to know, are other countries taking them seriously, even though Iceland is a small country?
Yes, some others are. I think Norway also aspires to be a carbon-free country quite quickly. Other countries certainly do want to be carbon-free, too, in the long run. Iceland, of course, does have a great advantage, which is that it has a lot of natural clean energy to begin with. A lot of its electricity comes from either hydroelectric dams or also natural steam geysers. They tap the steam and they use it to generate electricity. So those are clean sources of energy, so Iceland's got a leg up. But ultimately, most countries say that we'll have to be carbon-free or something close to it. It may take a century or two to get there.
We got a general question from listener Tony Hugel of Idaho Falls, and he writes, why has the news media replaced the term global warming with climate change? Is this effective PR by global warming deniers, or is there a scientific basis for using climate change instead of global warming?
Well, first of all, we use it interchangeably, global warming and climate change. And let's remember what we're really talking about here is a treaty that was signed in 1992 called the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. So it's actually the official term for this. And there's good reasons to call it climate change, not just global warming. Warming is one element of what's going on, but it may not actually be the most important element. Changes in rainfall pattern are likely to cause huge, huge disruptions globally and be a much more important problem than mere warming in some cases. So scientists actually prefer to say climate change because it actually wraps in things like droughts and rainfall and severe weather events and things like that that aren't captured in the phrase global warming.
Uh-huh. We got another listener question, and this one is from Gavin Witteveen of St. John's, Michigan, and he writes this, setting aside intentions and ambitions, what actually has changed from one summit to the next, and therefore, what should we pragmatically expect to result from the Copenhagen conclusions?
Well, I think we shouldn't totally set aside ambitions because I think that is one of the most important changes. We've never seen more than 100 heads of state coming together to talk about climate change, and that is really a remarkable thing here in Copenhagen. But it's also true that since, for example, the Kyoto Protocol was negotiated in 1997, China has gone from being a fairly minor emitter to the world's largest emitter, and that has made an enormous difference in the way that we think about it. China initially got a free pass, essentially, for dealing with its emissions because of its developing nation status. And now the United States and many other industrialized nations say, we can't have China just keep having its emissions grow and grow and grow. We can't give it a free pass anymore. And that's actually one of the major sticking points here.
And one last question on the U.S. role there. President Obama arrives in Copenhagen on Friday. What kind of commitment can he make on behalf of the U.S.? And then what is Congress's role in ratifying a treaty?
Right. The president learned from experience with Kyoto, which was that we promised something that turns out we couldn't deliver. And the reason we couldn't deliver the promises in Kyoto is that any treaty must be ratified by the Senate. And it takes 67 votes in the Senate to ratify a treaty. And that's tough to get to. So the strategy here has been, let's figure out what the Congress is willing to do first and then use that as the basis for our negotiating stance. It's tough because the Congress hasn't actually acted yet. So the president can only come and say, this is what we would like to do, but it's contingent on Congress acting. And that leaves a lot of people upset because he's not even making a firm promise here. But there are reasons that he's not.
Okay, Richard, thanks a lot.
Sure, my pleasure.
That's NPR's Richard Harris talking with us from Copenhagen. And thanks to all of you who sent in your questions.
And now the politics of energy and the environment in this country. ExxonMobil announced this week its biggest deal in a decade, buying the Houston-based natural gas company XTO Energy. That deal was seen as an indication of just how hot the natural gas industry is right now. With new technology to extract gas trapped in shale formations, the industry says it has a century's worth of domestic gas on tap. But that case has been hard to make on Capitol Hill, as NPR's Peter Overby reports.
ExxonMobil is paying $29 billion for XTO, the nation's number three natural gas producer. Here's Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson on a conference call with financial analysts.
We think this is a great transaction for the United States and for the consumers of the U.S.
He said that because gas emits half the carbons of coal. Advocates want Congress to promote it as a bridge fuel to replace coal in electrical generation till clean energy sources can take over. But when the House passed its climate change bill in June, natural gas producers couldn't get the incentives they wanted. Andrew Littlefair is the CEO of Clean Energy Fuels Corporation, a natural gas provider. When he held a conference call with Wall Street analysts, he said the gas producers failed at the lobbying game, and then they decided to fix it.
They just didn't have the right setup as an industry to protect themselves and promote themselves like they should. And so, you know, they pulled together a war chest of like $80 million, which may be less than what coal's got at their disposal. I'm not sure, but it put them in good stead.
The $80 million went to a new group, America's Natural Gas Alliance, or ANGA. Its mission is to make natural gas a major player on the Hill.
Obviously, we've focused on the Senate.
ANGA's chairman is David Trice. He notes that the Senate climate bill has stalled.
Which has been good for us because it's really given us time to spread the words on the abundance and benefits of natural gas.
And indeed, one key bill in the Senate would reward power companies if they switch out their dirtiest coal plants for natural gas. But action triggers reaction. For instance, Republican Senator Christopher Bond of Missouri. He says natural gas prices will escalate. At a hearing, he questioned Barry Hart from the Association of Missouri Electric Cooperatives.
Barry, if Missouri power generators are forced to switch from coal to natural gas, what would that do to power rates in Missouri?
It's the worst case scenario. If we switch to natural gas, you're looking at, by 2012, 46%.
That is a 46% increase in heating bills. Other lawmakers worry that drilling will contaminate drinking water. They're considering new federal environmental standards. It's a big issue in Pennsylvania and New York. A few weeks ago, protesters disrupted a regulatory hearing in New York City.
We don't want more hearings. We want peace.
Excuse me, sir. Would you please, sir?
The gas grid is dangerous.
Again, David Trice of the Natural Gas Alliance.
You know, it kind of reminds me of the healthcare debate and the screaming and shouting in YouTubes over death panels.
But oddly, ExxonMobil, the newest player in natural gas, is effectively locked out of this lobbying effort. That's because the company has spent millions upon millions of dollars fighting Congress's approach to climate change. At the liberal think tank Center for American Progress, Energy analyst Daniel Weiss says Exxon's opposition leads to a simple question of politics.
Why would any senator who wanted clean energy legislation listen to ExxonMobil, who comes to their office and says, put in this provision that I like, and by the way, I'm going to oppose the rest of your bill?
So natural gas producers are left with this paradox. ExxonMobil ranks as one of the most powerful lobby forces in Washington, and now it can be their ally. Except on this bill, when it isn't. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
Tomorrow, the world's largest particle collider will complete its inaugural run. There are lofty hopes for the Large Hadron Collider that it could reveal mysteries of the universe, but the collider has been marred by serious setbacks. It rumbled to life in the fall of 2008 and almost immediately broke down. This month, after a year of repairs, the collider finally began smashing together subatomic particles at record energies. Jeff Brumfield traveled to CERN, the particle physics lab in Geneva, to check it out.
It's the middle of the night, and I'm standing in a room that looks like mission control. There are huge flat-screen monitors lining the walls, and about a dozen people are watching those monitors really carefully. But instead of looking up, this mission control is looking down. About 300 feet below us is a detector the size of a five-story building. A phone rings. And Nikki Salidu picks up.
Okay, you don't want me to wake him up or anything.
Salidu is running the night shift here at the detector, which is called the Compact Muon Solenoid. This is one of four experiments at the Large Hadron Collider, or LHC. The LHC is the world's highest energy particle collider. It accelerates protons around a 16-mile underground racetrack, then smashes them together. The detector's job is to record the subatomic debris from the collision so that researchers can piece together what happens when the protons break apart. At the moment, the LHC is running 24/7, and that means Salidu won't be going to bed.
From 4 in the morning until 8 is my worst 4 hours. I really drink a lot of coffee and I start to feel tired. But I don't mind. I enjoy doing the shift because it brings you close to the real thing.
The real thing in this case is the chance to find something totally new. For decades, physicists have had the same view of the universe. They call it the Standard Model, and it's just what the name suggests. Sturdy, dependable, but a little boring. Scientists want a change, and if their calculations are right, the energy released by the LHC's collision should create something new. That something might be a particle that helps give everything mass, or maybe dark matter, which makes up much of the universe but hasn't been directly detected. There's even some who think the LHC will discover extra dimensions of space. The truth is that nobody knows. John Ellis is a theorist at CERN.
It'll be a little bit like watching somebody appear out of the fog. You're walking along through the fog, and then somebody comes out of the fog, and you start picking out various aspects, and then eventually you come face to face with the new physics. It's going to be very exciting.
Last September, scientists were ready to go. But just days after starting, the LHC had a major accident. A single connection, one of tens of thousands inside the collider, burned out during testing. The burnout caused massive damage that has taken over a year to fix. Again, John Ellis.
The mood at CERN has been a bit of a roller coaster over the last year and a half. There was obviously a tremendous amount of anticipation and excitement ahead of the startup last September. And then, of course, there was big depression a few days later when there was this electrical fault. Since then, I think probably the appropriate phrase is grim determination to get it right this time.
But getting it right isn't easy. The zipping protons are suspended by thousands of superconducting magnets, which must be kept freezing cold with tons of liquid helium. Everything needs to be timed to within a few trillionths of a second, or the particles won't collide. On top of it all, the LHC was built from scratch, and that makes it quirky. Mike Lamont helps keep it running.
There's subsystems out there with personalities of their own, usually a product of their creator.
So it's got a lot of personality, in other words.
Personality, I don't know. It's kind of a crankiness, I guess, if you can call that a personality trait.
The machine may be cranky, but since it started working, the researchers here have really cheered up. Today, they've come to CERN's cafeteria to lunch on fresh salad, roast veal, and other French delicacies. Literally thousands of scientists from all over the world are visiting right now, including Jim Strait. He normally works at Fermilab, America's main high-energy physics laboratory in Illinois.
CERN, really, for this sort of stuff, is by far and away the biggest, most cutting-edge place in the world. Fermilab, where I work, is number two. And at the moment, just surveying the cafeteria here, it seems like it's a long way from one to two.
This large-scale research takes people from all over the world to make it happen. Much of their time has been spent in their own laboratories, working on a tiny component or a piece of software. Now that the LHC is starting up, they all get to come to CERN together.
It's this place that is completely mobbed with geeks who are surrounded by other geeks and therefore in geek heaven, doing exactly what they want to do. You know, and the exciting thing is that we're going to learn new things about how the universe works, which is what us geeks like to do.
The mood at CERN is electric, and that's not just because the collider consumes as much electricity as the whole of Geneva.
Everybody's so jazzed that the machine's actually working now.
Zach Marshall is a graduate student on a detector called ATLAS.
But we're just waiting with bated breath because it's been so close so many times.
If nothing else goes wrong, the LHC will begin colliding in earnest early next year. For NPR News, I'm Jeff Brumfield.
Scientists have been able to detect hundreds of planets outside our solar system orbiting faraway stars. Mostly these planets seem to be gas giants, like Jupiter. But recently, astronomers have been getting closer to finding one like Earth. Earlier this year, they reported finding a small rocky planet. And as NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, they have now found one that's probably mostly water.
The name of this new planet is GJ-1214b. Every day and a half, it circles a small reddish star. Scientists detected the planet by watching that star. They saw the star dim slightly as the planet crossed in front of it and could see how the star wobbled as the planet's gravity pulled on it. All that told them the size of the planet and how much it weighed, letting them figure out what it's likely made of.
This is certainly the first planet around another star, which we think is mostly made of water.
That's David Charbonneau at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. He led the team, which is reporting on this planet in the journal Nature.
We think what we have here is a water world with a thin atmosphere surrounding it, perhaps of hydrogen and helium.
Pretend you could get in a spaceship and go to this planet, which you can't since it's 40 light years away, but if you could, first you'd see the dim red star. Then you'd see the planet, about 2.5 times the size of Earth, and shrouded in an alien atmosphere.
And then if you imagine descending down into that atmosphere, which I would advise against because of the very high pressure, and then looking back, you would slowly see this red, faint, illuminating star fade out of view and ultimately disappear from view just due to the thickness of the atmosphere.
You'd be in darkness, and then maybe splash into an ocean. Even though this planet is about 400 degrees Fahrenheit, the pressure of the atmosphere could keep water liquid. Liquid water usually excites scientists because it supports life on Earth. But Charbonneau says completely dark, super hot water under crushing pressures doesn't seem so friendly.
The surface of our planet probably wouldn't be anything like the surface of the Earth and therefore wouldn't host life as we know it.
He says additional telescope observations should reveal more about the planet's atmosphere. Mark Kushner is a planetary scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. He says it's possible this planet is made of something other than water, but the water world explanation is appealing, since our own solar system has planets like Neptune made of ice.
And it's easy to imagine a world like that located much closer to its star, so it's hot and the ice is melted into water.
Kushner says this is only the second time scientists have been able to figure out the likely composition of a planet not too much bigger than Earth around a distant star. That other planet is too dense to be made mostly of water. Instead, it's probably a super hot, rocky planet covered in lava. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
CT scans are commonplace in American medicine. A new study says they can also be dangerous. A group of researchers has found that patients commonly get too much radiation from these sophisticated x-rays, and some are predicting that radiation from CT scans will result in thousands of extra cancers in coming years. There's another development as well. Federal health authorities are investigating reports of dangerous radiation from CT scans at several hospitals in California and Alabama. NPR's Richard Knox has the story.
It's not news that x-rays can cause cancer, but people thought the benefits from the amazingly detailed pictures produced by CT scanners far outweigh the cancer risk. Researchers at the National Cancer Institute and other institutions decided to estimate the risk from the 72 million CT scans done in this country in one recent year. Their answer? 29,000 people will get cancer because of the CT scans they had in 2007. Each year adds another 29,000 or more, at least until the radiation dose or the number of scans is cut. Dr. Rita Redberg is editor of the Archives of Internal Medicine, which is publishing the research. She calls the problem a public health time bomb.
In 20 to 30 years, we're going to be seeing tens of thousands of excess cancers due to the increased radiation that people are incurring now.
Another study in the journal drills down into the problem. It looks at the radiation doses patients are actually getting every day in four large San Francisco area hospitals.
No one really appreciates the doses that are used in actual clinical practice, and they're much higher than we have thought. And the variation in dose is dramatic.
That's Dr. Rebecca Smith-Beinman of the University of California at San Francisco. She led that study. It finds that half the patients getting the most common CT scans to check for cancer, heart disease, strokes, blood clots in the lungs, and so on, are getting more radiation than they should, sometimes much more. Also, radiation doses varied enormously from one hospital to another, and even within the same hospital, for images of the same body part. Smith-Beinman says patients are getting so many scans because they expect their doctors to order them. Some people have even gotten whole-body CT scans at malls just to make sure they don't have any health problems.
Patients definitely want imaging. They're entitled to imaging, and they don't appreciate that imaging, in fact, comes with this potential harm.
But there's no doubt that doctors are mainly responsible for the skyrocketing popularity of CT scans. Dr. James Thrall is chairman of the American College of Radiology. He says there's a definite wow factor from CT scanning. It's like a virtual tour of the patient's insides.
Many of us sort of became hooked on ever better image quality before we came to the realization, the epiphany, that it was the diagnosis that was important and not the quality of the image.
Thrall says at his institution, the Massachusetts General Hospital, doctors who order a CT scan must list the reason. A computer program gives it a score. A low score indicates the test is probably unnecessary.
Our experience over the past 5 years has been rather phenomenal. Before we instituted the system, the annual growth rate for CT scanning was 12%, a remarkable number. After we instituted the system, that dropped to 1%.
Which is less than the growth in the hospital's patient load. In other words, now there are fewer scans per patient. Thrall thinks the claim that CT scans will cause 29,000 extra cancers a year is overstated. But whatever the number, he says,
there are opportunities for us in the field of radiology to do all the good things we do using less radiation.
He says scanner companies are working on machines that make good pictures using less radiation, but it will take years before the thousands of current machines are replaced. In the meantime, the College of Radiology and others are trying to figure out how to cut the radiation doses and the unnecessary CT scans that patients are now getting. Richard Knox, NPR News.